Professor Ibrahim Musa, welcome to Conversation With.
Thank you for having me.
What exactly is blasphemy?
Blasphemy means to offend a deity or any kind of sacred objects that people might cherish. So when you blaspheme one of these sacred objects, it normally elicits a certain kind of anger, displeasure, or there are certain consequences to that.
But this idea of, as you say, dishonor, is it consistent though? Is there a generalized, accepted interpretation by all the different religious scholars about what it is to insult a sacred object?
I think at one point in our history, when societies were governed by empires and we had imperial systems, in those imperial systems, religion played a prominent role. So you had the Persians, the Romans, the Byzantines, Eastern empires, where the emperor was linked to divine connections, and the emperor's shadow or the emperor's authority linked to a certain kind of divine authority. And in that way, offending the emperor, offending the powers and the office of the emperor could be a serious offense. And that would always be interpreted as being an offense to the deity that placed the emperor in the world. So it's in that way that we then develop these notions of blasphemy and offense. And sometimes when you satirize a political leader, it could result in certain forms of instability, it could create quarrels. And so in order to keep order, there were these laws and rules and regulations set in that today we call blasphemy.
So from what I understand, you're saying it's because we had a conflation, a mixing or an overlapping of the ideas of the authority of, let's say, some kind of a king or ruler and the deity. So the two are fused together. But isn't that a bit more difficult now in our secular world where we have tried to separate the two things?
Absolutely. One of the great difficulties is that the idea of blasphemy is linked to theocratic orders, right? So when you have a theocracy. Now, when you have a different kind of order, a political order that, say, for instance, cherishes the secular order is the governing order, and the religion has a different space, which we call a privatized space, in that context, the rules of the game has begun to change.
Wouldn't it be easier to change many of these old blasphemy laws into a more modern version, which in some countries they would have things which are basically racial or religious hatred laws?
I think in many places where you do have, you know, restrictions on freedom, it's precisely for this reason, and that is that, you know, if you do incitement, you create hatred, you insult people, that can create social disorder and dysfunction. We have such regulations. And, in many countries, the freedom of speech is not absolute, even in democracies. So if you say something treasonous, if you do an act that violates the symbols of the country. In the U.S. many years ago, a flag burning was seen as an act of treason. Since then, the Supreme Court has changed its view on that matter. So I think even, for instance, in the U.K. many years ago, when I was a cub journalist, one of the things I learned that to consort with the daughter of the sovereign is an act of treason. So there are many things that of ancient relics that still, and I think what you're pointing out is this question of blasphemy is a tricky issue, because it falls in different cleavages of the way in which we deal with the question of religion.
What about the case of Indonesia, where the governor of Jakarta, Basuki Cahayapurnama, although more commonly known as Ahok, was supposed to have blasphemed and has actually been convicted of it. So how, for example, would a non-Muslim know when they are being blasphemous?
Well, first of all, blasphemy laws are, you know, it's part of the law of many countries, but many of the citizens don't know what the law is about, right? And so oftentimes what it takes is somebody who's disgruntled or has a bone to pick or want to engage in a certain kind of political duel with an opponent can quickly, through clever lawyering, find that law and say so-and-so has blasphemed. I can give you an example before we go to Indonesia. A friend of mine, Nasser Hamid Abu Zaid, was a professor at Cairo University, and he wrote many books on interpretation of Islam, and he put himself up for promotion at the university. Some people didn't like his views. He was more leftist inclined. He began to talk about the text and its interpretation and multiple sides to that interpretation. And they denied him promotion. But also, some people, activists outside that started saying, this person holding these kinds of views is no longer a proper Muslim. And with the result, his case was dragged through 3-4 courts in Egypt, and finally the highest court then declared that the views he held were no longer consistent with proper Islamic beliefs, and as a result of that, the petition was that he can no longer be married to his wife because he's no longer a Muslim, so end of his marriage, and he had to leave Egypt, you know, for safety, and went to the Netherlands, and he died a couple of years ago. So these issues occur in many societies where the question of religion has not been fully settled within a national context. The modern nation state talks about religion being the realm of the private, and the public will be governed by secular. But in many places, the public and the private gel with each other. There's an intersection.
But doesn't that make it very uncertain for an ordinary citizen in our modern world?
I think it makes it very uncertain. So for instance, you asked about the question, what gives offense, right? So you know that we don't shout fire in a full cinema because it can create a stampede and people can get hurt. We know in terms of laws that if you use racial epithets that can provoke people, that can be very strong. So that is clear. Now, blasphemy laws in Islam has been subject to a colonial history. So wherever the British went, the British introduced blasphemy laws in order to take control of religion. And so when people in India and other parts of the former English countries and English colonial countries still suffer some of that legacy. Now, what has happened in Indonesia is that the adversaries of Governor Ahok used a certain verse of the Quran to say that a person of his faith commitment should not be subject, should not be trusted. He then responded, and when he responded, there was some doctoring with his response, and he was made out to have criticized the Quran. Now, that would be seen now as he had blasphemed or he had violated the sensibilities of Muslims. That first of all, comes to the world as a great shock, because Indonesia is seen as a country that has pluralistic Islamic tendencies. It is open to multiple ways of understanding what Islam is. There are different interpretations of Islam. So first of all, it came a shock to many people in the world that Indonesia religion comes up, plays such a central role. This man was already elected previously by a largely Muslim electorate.
How do you think, though, that we can make things more clear? What would you recommend? Both, one, first as a professor, but second also as a Muslim, in the sense that if you were to say, okay, how do you, as a believing Muslim, know whether or not you've been blasphemous?
So part of the difficulty we have in these matters is that these are matters of ancient theological history, but they also still have a certain amount of resonance amongst religious audiences. So first of all, it requires religious leaders, theologians, to sit down and begin to rewrite these rules. Because it's not only that. In other countries outside of Indonesia, the penalties for blasphemy are quite serious. So you have, besides blasphemy, apostasy, but certain kinds of blasphemy and apostasy can warrant the death penalty. Saudi Arabia, Iran. So these come with very serious implications, and these date back to ancient times. So the issue is that Muslim theologians must come together and say, we live in a different world. We don't no longer live in a world of empire where religion and theocratic orders regulated. A different kind of norms now regulate the national sphere, but also the global sphere. So first job is the Muslim theologians must rewrite these rules. And once they rewrite these rules, you need to educate the publics. And then accordingly, also the laws of many of those countries have to then be amended to reflect the new sensibility of what constitutes blasphemy.
Your starting point, though, of the theologians being able to come to some sort of agreement, that may not be the case, is it, Prof? I mean, they can't come to an agreement. We see many, many differing views.
But I believe that given the fact that the religion is so prevalent in many parts of the world and rising in other places where people thought that religion is going to die out, religion has come back with a vengeance. So basically, we have to deal with those people, and one should be inclusive. There's to be a multiple set of views of theologians and experts and so on coming around. But governments can draw them to the table and say, listen, and sensible governments. Now, what also happens is politicians get embroiled in these issues because they keep on watching at their voter base. So if they can satisfy a vote bank and say, you know, I'm a more zealous Muslim than the other one, they're playing with fire. And sometimes this fire is going to burn. Now, Egypt doesn't have the death penalty for blasphemy, but other countries do. But that issue where Sunni and Shia theologians will have to sit down and say, we are no longer going to advocate this idea of the death penalty, because that makes it extremely dangerous for anybody who says something. So, for instance, you've seen in Bangladesh, for instance, that a number of writers and bloggers had been killed by militants. It could be issues of religion, it could be issues of politics, and yet these militants use these very dangerous theological and risky theological doctrines to their advantage, knowing that in Muslim publics there's a sensitivity about questions of religion, and they might, while they disagree with the militants' methods, they might also say that the offender did offend. So it neutralizes the situation, and that is extremely dangerous. That's what I call, that there are a number of what I call undetonated theological hand grenades. Undetonated theological hand grenades that are lying around, that the only people who can detonate them would be Muslim communities, Muslim religious leaders, people of concern, intellectuals that need to talk to those issues. Otherwise, extremists and demagogues are going to make use of those doctrines for their own advantage.
Isn't that exactly what we're seeing now with, let's say, Islamic State, where they are using some of these ideas? In fact, some would say that they have detonated some of these ideas.
Oh, absolutely. It's only when I started thinking about how does people who are sympathetic to Islamic State kill journalists at Charlie Hebdo, or, you know, other journalists being subject to threats and so on, and developments in different parts of the world. It's when thinking through those issues that I realized that these militants are choosing these undetonated theological hand grenades to their advantage, and they know it will not provoke, it will not elicit the level of condemnation, because they're playing with a wedge issue here, where there is both religious sentiment attached to it, but most Muslims will not agree with the death penalty, but they will understand that Charlie Hebdo did offend. And so it creates a certain amount of ambivalence in the response.
So you're talking about there's a difference between the actual sort of, say, offense and the penalty that there should be attached to the offense, and the whole thing gets all mixed up.
All get mixed up. And the militants, for instance, they don't engage in this rethinking and reevaluating the doctrines of Islam. They're not interested in that. They want to go back to very medieval understandings.
But this reflexive thinking that you're urging, is that actually taught in madrasas?
Well, I think in some madrasas are being taught, and I'm now engaged in a major project in which I am working with small numbers of recently graduated madrasa students in India and Pakistan, and deepening their scientific and theological literacy. And the reason I've chosen scientific and theological literacy as part of a growing literacy is because we need to bring the knowledge of our world and our experience into the theological conversation. One of the great difficulties that many Muslim theologians have in coming to the page of revising certain doctrines and rules is because their own training is in medieval texts, and they're not on the page of the modern world and the modern experience. So hence the modern experience, the modern sensibilities do not manifest themselves in their theological teachings. They keep on going back to theological teachings that they think are valid from a different time and place. So it becomes anachronistic.
But what if I were to argue, so to say, the other point of view, which would say that what you're urging, sir, is in fact totally unacceptable, that it's not supposed to be about our modern world, that our modern world is corrupt, And therefore, that's why there is this looking to a more ideal world, possibly in the past.
Every generation of Islam added their contribution by weaving the rope of tradition. So this tradition that we have in our hands dates back to ancient times, but every generation weaves its own experience into theology and into moral understandings of things. Without that, you don't have religion. Religion constantly updates itself to contemporary experiences. So I think the idea that saying that the world is corrupt is a perspectival thing, because the world we have is the best we have. We don't have any other experiences, and the experience, our experience must count. And if Muslims are not going to do that, then the teachings are increasingly going to be ones that's going to give them difficulties, and adaptation is going to be difficult, and you know, Muslim communities are going to suffer. But and all communities who have been stubborn in these matters have had to revise certain things, and that is exactly how Islamic knowledge goes. And one of the things I'm advocating, that human dignity is the centerpiece of Islamic teachings. So today we cannot have teachings that violate human dignity.
Did you have that taught when you went to a madrasa?
Well, I think that I was taught some things of that order, but it was also taught in a very orthodox fashion. What I had to do is to, once I left the madrasas, I had to revise a number of things I studied there. But one of the things the madrasas provide you with is it provides you with the tools that you can grapple and make and remake those ancient doctrines. It gives you that skill. People who are not in that tradition don't have that facility to argue that complex theological debate.
Yet, Professor, you have a classmate who became a religious teacher, an imam, but then went on to Syria to join Islamic State. How's that? You both came from the same madrasa.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that the most unexpected things happen that one would have thought that this colleague, Rashid Musaji, who was senior to me and was a critic of mine when I was in my earlier iteration as a young upstart theologian, I was thinking about questions about politics, and he used to chastise me. So it seems that what happens is that when people have crises, they go for these hard options. And I think Rashid was totally confused at the end of the day, that after practicing and advocating Islam for at least 3 or 4 decades as a theologian in South Africa, he decided to go for this option. Oftentimes, militants and extremist views also has to do with the psychology of those who join them. So when people are struggling with guilt, when people are struggling with great difficulty that they want redemption for, they think that extremism is the quick path to redemption. So madrasas do have a role to play, but not in their current iteration, especially in South Asia. They need to update themselves with contemporary knowledge and really have this robust conversation about theology, as Muslims had 500, 600, 800 years ago. They had robust conversations. They inherited Greek knowledge, and they took this Greek knowledge as part of their own legacy and held that as a vital part in order to explain and interpret Islam in the world in which they lived. Today, we have to do the same with the knowledge of our time, to be part of an intimate conversation of our life experiences and our legacies, and what is the good in this world, and how do we promote the common good, and how do we promote human dignity. Killing people, executing people, doing acts of demagoguery, charging people of blasphemy does not really advocate the good.
What of people who say that moderate Muslims, although that may in itself be insulting, Muslims should in themselves presumably be moderate, but what about they who argue that moderate Muslims are not speaking out enough against extremism or violent expressions or interpretations of Islam?
So, you know, the very concept of moderate Muslim, or as the Quran talks about Ummah Wasat, Ummatan Wasatan, which means a median community, and one that finds the median in extremities and so on. So that's what people mean often by moderate Muslims. Sometimes people are critical of the term moderate Muslims because it might mean that you are very sympathetic to a liberal perspective, or you're very sympathetic to a Western perspective. But I think those are unfair comments. Moderate Muslims are always advocating what is the best values of Islam to come to the fore.
Final question, sir. What advice would you give to a young Muslim looking to do something good in society, looking to contribute? What advice would you give to them?
My advice would be, try and do the good that common sense tells you is the good. Don't look for the good that has Islamic bells and whistles, because oftentimes when you look for that with an Islamic bells and whistles, in other words, you want some kind of Islamic justification for it, then you're going to end up in very dangerous places, because you're going to say the only good must be done with an Islamic sign attached to it. The good can be that you can help orphans, teach people literacy, excel at what you are doing, and be an innovator, be audacious, be humble in your audacity, but be audacious, think outside the box, and advance human dignity. That is the highest aspiration one can do within an Islamic teaching. Advancing human dignity, but also advancing humanity at large, is part of an Islamic mission. Those ideas that you want for certain kind of particular Islamic things that has a particular Islamic color might serve a short-term goal, but it will prevent you from doing the service to humanity. And that is Islam's central message. But unfortunately, the way things are taught right now is that they're looking for Islamic particularity and Islamic exceptions. Islam is universal. Islam is asking humanity to do the good, and that people of all faiths must join hands in order to advance the good.
Professor, thank you very much for being in conversation with.
Thank you for asking me, and it was a great pleasure.